Hello, Worcester and the world. This is Public Hearing, a podcast and radio show from Action by Design about engaging communities to address social problems in a way that centers equity, justice, and the pursuit of joy-filled futures for everyone. I am your host and founder of Action by Design, Joshua Croak. Pursuing equitable, just, and joy-filled futures for everyone is an action of the present. It is something that needs to be acted upon now in order for us to see these outcomes later. Last week, I shared that I'd give some insight into how we approach our work at Action by Design, and I think that this is a really important acknowledgement that I'll say again. The pursuit of equitable, just, and joy-filled futures is an action of the present. We are too often told in this work and in social justice movements, well, these things take time. Yes, they do take time, but that argument is most often used as an excuse to not address critical issues in society now, or as an intentional diversion to shift the focus away from these efforts entirely. This is the core of Action by Design's work, helping communities articulate their vision for the future and then developing an action plan that helps move them toward that goal. This week, we are wrapping up our formal mini-season on the topic of early childhood education and care with someone who has been a childcare worker for years supporting children and their families directly. And don't worry, this isn't the last time we'll address early childhood on Public Hearing, as we've already received recommendations from you, our listeners, about other folks doing this work, parents who have struggled to navigate finding and financing childcare, and youth who have experiences to share as well. We'll be doing follow-up episodes surrounding the topics of our mini-seasons, so please do reach out to our team at publichearing.co. This is the Public Hearing Podcast. Today, we are continuing our conversation around early childhood education and care with Vanessa Martinez. Vanessa has been working in her passion field of early education and care since 1993 and has been with the YWCA of Central Massachusetts Early Education and Care Program for 16 years, most recently as their assistant director and the subsidy administrator, where she oversees more than 120 families that received subsidized care through the Department of Early Education and Care. Vanessa is also a mentor at Project Flourish that helps workers in the early childhood space receive their CDAs, or Child Development Associates Accreditation. This program allows early ed workers to continue working during the day and participate in online classes at night. Vanessa is a bilingual Latina who was born in Rio Piedras, Puerto Rico, whose family moved to Worcester when she was 3 months old. Vanessa grew up in a conservative Christian home where it was expected that the father went to work and the mother stays home with the family. So Vanessa has broken that mold by committing to her career in early childhood education and care, the care field, while also being a mom, a wife, and involved in many other community initiatives. Vanessa, thank you so much for joining us today. I always like to provide space for our guests to add to their intro so they can highlight any experiences or other parts of your story that you want to bring into this space that might not get covered in a bio. So welcome, and what else can you tell us about you, and what would you like our audience to know about the importance of your work?
Thank you, Joshua, for inviting me to the show. Like you had mentioned earlier, this has been my passion since I can remember. Working with children and families is what I've wanted to do all my whole life. But it wasn't until 2007 when the field of early childhood shifted into a new direction. There was a lot of more demands on teachers where teachers needed to go back to school. And that's where I had to stop and think, is this what I wanted to do for the rest of my life? And I have tried working in other fields, but I always come back to early childhood. This is my passion. This is where I belong. So with that said, I started getting lots of resources throughout the community, through Prince Sigmund Community College, Worcester State. I had lots of mentors that had also mentored me throughout my experience, where I was able to get my degrees in early childhood. And now, working at the YWCA, a company that focuses on empowering women and eliminating racism, that's something that I've always wanted to do. So in the job that I'm doing right now, I'm also mentoring teachers. I'm also helping them come out of their comfort zone and do what they're born to do. And again, I've also worked with the Department of Children and Families as a foster parent. I did that for about 5 years, but the demand got a little bit too much for me, going to school full-time, being a full-time mother, a wife. So I kind of had to, like, back down from that. But, again, that's something that, you know, has been my passion, to work with children and families.
Well, thank you for being here and, you know, bringing your voice and experience to our conversations around early education and care. We've learned from folks like Amy O'Leary and Eve Gilmore and Kim Davenport around the advocacy work and a lot of the challenges that folks face, and you having regular interface with kids and families. I'm really thrilled that you're here to talk to us today. And you mentioned the changes in the field and the requirements on early educators and early care workers for needing to pursue degrees to have that employment. And as someone who was working in the field prior to some of those requirements, I'm interested, could you share a little bit, and you touched on this a bit, but how was the support that you received from the organizations that you were working with, or and maybe this is your story or the story of other folks in this space that you've heard of, like, what are the pathways and support that folks receive if they want to maintain their career in this field but need to seek that additional education?
Yes, that's very important, Joshua. So back in 2007, when all that started shifting, there were lots of resources. You know, they were offering the early childhood educators a lot of support. They were offering babysitters for mothers, single mothers, to be able to have their children taken care of while they went to school. They were offering classes in our facility, which was, that was phenomenal. That was very important for those teachers that didn't have transportation. But they also started offering scholarships. So teachers that worked in the field for a year or more were able to apply for the early childhood education scholarships. And that was a great advantage for someone like me that wouldn't qualify for other resources. Being, you know, coming from a family where my husband also worked, a lot of those resources I wouldn't qualify for, but, you know, having to pay daily expenses, lots of things that you have to do, would put a burden on me, financially. So having those scholarships in place helped a lot. The FAFSA was also one of them that, supported us early childhood educators. And again, it's just, you know, having the right mentors, which, again, I can say that I was so blessed to have all those mentors in place. We had somebody coming over to our program where they would kind of sit down with us and kind of like develop an educational plan and see what we wanted to do, how many classes we wanted to take, and take it from there. In the beginning, because I was first new to it, I did take only one class at a time. And then eventually I started increasing my courses and taking 2 to 4 courses per year. But yes, the resources in the community helped tremendously.
And I was going to ask, were those resources unique to the YW? Were they community-based resources? Were they state resources? Because I'm interested in some of the experiences that other folks have in the space as well, accessing support and, you know, funding for their education to do this work.
So working in this field and, you know, doing this for so many years right now, I've noticed that back then when all that started, we had a lot of support, a lot of coaching, a lot of like hand holding, a lot of support that would come in and help us throughout the whole process. It was new to everybody, so we weren't sure what we needed to do. We even had somebody come and help us do our FAFSA, something as simple as that, that we wouldn't know how to do at the beginning. So now after the years have gone by, now we use our own selves as support for other educators. So since we've already gone through the process, now we're able to support others. But again, there's such a need right now, such a crisis in the field where we're not even having educators coming in and getting into the field.
So when you mention that crisis in early childhood education, you know, what does that crisis look like to you and the folks that you work with?
It's very draining, not having the teachers that we need. Right now, you know, I work for a center that's accredited, where we have quality teachers. But with that said, because we put so much demand on them, the pay is not backing it up. So their salary is not there. The adequate, proper salary that they should be receiving is not there. And we ask, you know, one of the biggest things that we ask and we advocate for politicians, legislators, our local leaders to step in and make some noise, only because, you know, early childhood educators plays a very important role in the lives of the children, early young children. And without those early educators there, we wouldn't have these quality centers, and we wouldn't have the centers where the parents can rely on to be able to go to work.
Yeah. And for listeners, who have been following the show, we talked about how over 37% of early educators and care workers are eligible for some type of federal or state assistance because they're making below a certain like level of poverty level wages, right? And you know what you're talking about is so critically important to say the work is crucial, right? We are educating and supporting our youth and families. And not only that, we're supporting their parents and the folks that are supporting raising them so that they can be out in their career fields or, you know, doing, you know, moving about their day to day in support of the community, in support of their families, et cetera. And so what do you feel, having been in this field for a while, what do you feel are some of the reasons that early educators and care workers have not been given that acknowledgement?
Well, you know, in working in the field for as many years as I've worked in, I've also heard the term where we're known as glorified babysitters, which is a little bit offensive, because early childhood educators, you know, they go to school. They vest their time into learning what it is to take and blossom children from birth all the way through kindergarten, and to be not to be acknowledged as somebody important. You know, it kind of like puts you to think, you know, should I continue on with this field? Luckily, you know, the early child educators that I've come across, they've all been very passionate about what they do. They're in it because they love what they're doing. But at the same time, you know, we should be able to back it up and compensate them for what they do. They're very hard workers. Not only do they go to school, but they also have to develop weekly curriculums for the classroom. They have to do 20 hours of teacher training developments a year. They have to have their first aid and CPR. They have to attend monthly staff meetings. They have to do children's assessments 4 times a year. The same thing that public schools is pretty much doing right now. So it is a lot of demands that we do expect the teachers to be doing, but also to be able to make sure that the children are thriving and are developing where they need to be.
Absolutely. And when we spoke with Eve Gilmore from Edwards Street, she put an emphasis on, we don't just need early education and care, which is very true. We need high quality early education and care for every child, you know, with the supports and the resources that you're talking about to really, you know, and this is an equity issue, right? You know, who is able to access high quality education and care programs often has a paywall, right? Of who's able to access based on what they can afford. And, you know, when we were talking to Kim, Amy, and Eve, I think they all brought up the fact that regardless of your income as a family, people are paying upwards of $20,000 a year to support this. So in your role as subsidy administrator, you know, what stands out to you about what families are facing today that our listeners should be aware of from accessing high quality care and education?
So right now, I noticed with the whole pandemic, a lot of families have lost their jobs. They have gotten their hours cut where, you know, if they were working 40 hours, now they're working 20. They're working per diem. So they're not even sure what hours they're going to be working that week. the EEC has been graciously developed a plan where we're able to provide parents ongoing subsidy, whether they're meeting the criteria of working 30 hours or more, in order to get them into the field, to get them to be able to look for work, get training if they need to go to school, but just to ease up that burden on the families. But that's one of the things that the families are constantly coming into my office worried about. Am I going to lose my care? Am I going to lose my care? And then because these families have been in our care for years, they've had siblings coming in after siblings into our program, we develop this really strong relationship where they trust to bring their children into our care, and they're able to leave comfortable, to go to work, look for work. So to think about that, you're going to lose your care and then start over, you know, it's mind-boggling for them. So, you know, as a subsidy administrator, I'm always doing my homework. I'm always trying to help them, you know, in advance and try to give them tips on what they should be doing, try to help them out to maintain their subsidy. And being bilingual, we do have a lot of bilingual families that I'm also thankfully able to help to be able to translate into a language that they're able to understand.
I want to underscore one of the things that you said there about the importance of like building trusting relationships with families, because I think relationship building is so critical, especially when people are used to systems not truly working for them or truly representing them. So how do you go about, you know, building those relationships, and what is the value of trust, you know, in your field?
Well, my belief, and like I tell all the teachers in my program, first impression is a lasting impression. You have to start that relationship from day one. From the minute you meet that parent, you need to start that relationship as well as the child. Yes, we're all human. We all have personal issues that everybody faces on a daily basis, but that stays at the door. The minute we come in the door, we're all about our families and the children.
Absolutely. And so you mentioned as well the importance of like providing like bilingual services and things, which is so crucial. You know, the Worcester Public Schools has over 90 languages spoken in our community. And you yourself learned to speak and write English at 9 years old, right here in Worcester at Belmont Community School. Yeah. So many of our students still are English language learners. And what was that experience like for you? And how do you see young kids kind of coming into these programs with like English language learning as a support and an education that they need?
Yeah, so that, you know, that plays a big role into having those positive relationships with the children and families. I remember at 9 years old, learning how to speak English. I would, you know, be taken out of the classroom for 30-minute sessions to read and point things out. And within that year, the teachers felt that I was ready enough to be in an all-English classroom. And I still remember, like today, when I had to be in this classroom, I was in fourth grade, and I felt like I was in high school. And I could not understand, like I was just lost. And I sympathize with that with my family, so I try to be there for them as much as I can, whether it's through language, interpretation. With the children, we do a lot of sign language, and we try to get the parents' input and the parents involved as much as we can. A few years back, I remember when I was working in the classroom, I had a little boy that was from Japan, and he didn't know English. The mother did not know English, so the only one that I could rely on was the dad. And in order to help this child thrive and to understand us, I had to have him make up this little chart and write up some words in Japanese. But he would write in a way that I could say it and pronounce it, so the little boy could understand their son. And then it wasn't until I started saying the words that I could tell in the little boy's face that he's like, oh my gosh, he knows my language. And he would start talking. I'm like, oh my goodness, I don't understand. I would try and try. But it's just those relationships, just trying, you know, the partnering up with families and working together, collaborating together. Because, you know, in all honesty, what we want the best for their child is the same way that they do. we want the same outcome for the child.
Absolutely. If you had, you know, and I'll use like the magic wand exercise, right? Of like, if you had a magic wand and you could identify 3 to 5 things that you wish that you had or other educators and workers in the early childhood space had as supports to continue to amplify the work that you do, what would some of those things be?
So, thinking about the early childhood educators right now, one of the things that we are in desperate need of, like I said before, is more teachers in the field. Right now, because we don't have the teachers, a lot of us are doing the work of 2 and 3 people, just trying to fill that need. So more teachers, I would say more timing. There is a lot of things that we demand on the teachers. So to even have that time for them to be able to have time to do these weekly curriculums, invest time in what their weekly planning would be great. The timing, the pay, it's a big factor. Having the salaries to increase. And I would say also probably more support for teachers. Like I mentioned before, we still have a lot of teachers that are single mothers, don't have a vehicle. So even if we could come up with a way to provide those services for them, where they can have some sort of transportation and even childcare for them to be able to continue on in the field, I think those would be, you know, good areas to start with the teachers.
Fantastic. And so you're in the classroom and working with kids on a, you know, daily basis. How are young children as we work our way through the pandemic? How are they doing?
So right now, pre-COVID, everything seemed normal, as what we considered normal. But now with the whole pandemic, we have seen a change in the way the children have been progressing. So right now, normally we have seen an increase in children with behavioral problems, children with that need services with developmental delays. So normally, like in a toddler classroom, children that go into a toddler classroom go in there at 15 months old, and they're in there until they're 2 years and 9 months. But right now we're seeing a lot of toddlers entering a toddler classroom still at an infant level and staying that way for a while. And the same as a preschool classroom. When they enter a preschool classroom, they're more at a toddler level. So we've seen a big delay in their developmental.
For parents listening, especially for new parents, I'm sure folks are hearing this and there's a concern of like, what can we do to, you know, support our kids? And in this, are there recommendations or resources that you have for parents who are concerned about some of the things that we're seeing because of the pandemic?
Yes, definitely. So the first thing that we do is 1 month after a child has entered our program, the parents have the opportunity to do a screening. It's called Ages and Stages, where it's like a checklist where they're able to see where their child is at developmentally. The teacher also gets to do that checklist, and then they get to compare it and talk about what would work, what wouldn't work. But after the child has been in the classrooms and you get to know the child, you get to understand if the child is at the level they're supposed to be at, or if we need to refer them to other services. So as an infant and toddler, one of the resources that we always tend to refer them is to early intervention. When we refer them to early intervention, the parents has to consent. We make it easier for the family. So early intervention, depending on the organization, they will come to our program and do the screening. The parent has to be part of that screening. It takes about 2 hours, but they're able to see if the child needs some support in any of their developmental areas. And then once they qualify for the screening, then it's just a matter of setting up these visits, having the early intervention come into a program and do these one-on-one sessions with the child where they're able to work independently. Once the child turns 3 years old, they no longer qualify for early intervention. But if it's something that the child needs to be referred for further support, they get referred to the public school system and then they do their separate screening. So there are lots of resources that we follow up with families and, you know, with the help of the educators that we have. Without them, we couldn't make this possible. They're pretty much our eyes and ears in the classrooms when working with these children. So together we can make it happen for the families.
And that's a great segue in our last couple minutes here around, you know, you mentioned the need for more teachers, advocating for, you know, wages that enable folks to be able to thrive, not even just meet their basic needs, but thrive in these, in this field to, so people want to and get involved with this work. So what should policymakers, you know, our legislators, what should they know about your work? Like, what do you want them to hear?
So that is the number one question that is the very important. So I'm a very visual person and I like to like explain things in a way that people can understand and see. So the way that I see it is just like an architect and a contractor. When they're going to build a house or some type of structure, they focus on that first foundation, on the structure. Once they focus on that foundation and that they're able to build that solid foundation, they know that's going to be able to hold the structure. The same way early childhood educators are. They're the first people in the field of the life of a child, aside from the parents, that are building that strong foundation from birth all the way up through age 8. The children thrive by being nurtured, by being taken care of, by having those daily interactions that early childhood educators do on a daily basis. The same thing as a plant. When you want a plant to grow, when you plant that seed, you need to nurture it, you need to water it, you need to give it sunlight. That's the same thing that early childhood educators do. So I do ask that policymakers, politicians, on a state level, national level, to really open their eyes and focus on the crisis that we're facing right now. Because without these educators, I don't know what's going to be. I don't know what would happen. But I do thank and appreciate every one of those educators out there.
Well, thank you for the work that you do. I so value and respect the work that you do and all of our early education and care workers. You've been listening to Public Hearing. Thank you so much, Vanessa Martinez, for coming on our show today. Our podcast and radio show that airs Wednesdays at 6 p.m. on WICN 90.5 FM, Worcester's only NPR affiliate station, and can be heard wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm your host, Joshua Croak. If you have ideas for the show or would like to become a supporter, reach out to our team at Public Hearing. Our audio producer is Giuliano D'Orazio, who also made our show music. Thank you to Molly Gammon and An Dao for also supporting this show. It is created and produced by Action by Design, a social innovation and change agency helping people imagine and materialize equitable and just futures. Learn more at actionbydesign.co. And as always, thanks for listening.